numbers told the story they always do.
It's one of those idiots who believe in analytics.
This is a numbers game with Gil Alexander on VSiN.
Good Tuesday morning to you. It is a numbers game at Visa, the Sports Betting Network, Visa.com, Game Plus, iHeart Radio. I almost said iHeart. iHeart Radio. YouTube TV. Where did that come from?
And iHeart too, if you're out there.
Yeah, if you're out there, that's quite the network as well. It's Gil Alexander. It's Kelly Bidlin live from Bar Canada the D. What's happening?
Not much, man. We got a little black and white cookie thing going on the past 2 days.
I
was in
that.
Black yesterday, you were in white, and now we've flip-flopped.
Yeah, you said that to me this morning. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
What are you like? Your fashion.
Found it interesting. Well, we're doing long shots later.
It's called long shots.
I got to rock the jacket, you know what I mean? But then you want to be a little bit more casual for this one.
I hear you, man. So long shots, obviously, if you've been trapped under a heavy object, the U.S. Open, golf's third major of the year. We always have to take that pause. The PGA now is second.
Yeah.
Golf's third major of the year happening this week. How many times does long shots air? 4, 7? How many times?
It's a great question. I don't know. We will be recording today. We'll be up in podcast form today, and then it will be live on the video side. Not live. We'll be airing on the video side tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern time, and then I believe later Wednesday night as well.
So right after a numbers game tomorrow.
Yes.
It's called Long Shots.
It's called Long Shots.
U.S. Open betting preview tomorrow, noon Eastern, with Kelly Bidlin, Matt Brown, and the great Wes Reynolds.
Actually, we'll just keep calling it live because I want to see it. I want to see everybody tweet in about how I ran over to Circa and changed so quickly.
Sprinted.
4 minutes tomorrow.
Avoiding shivving.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I want to start with some. By the way, on the show today, Drew Dinsick will join us, talk NBA playoffs, obviously, NBA finals, what he learned in the French, maybe look ahead to see how he's going to tackle Wimbledon, all kinds of things. His thoughts on the U.S. Open as well, because I know he participates in Calcutta's and that sort of thing. Paul Sporer on baseball a little later, and Byron Lindekew. Byron Lindekew is the host of the Back Nine Bets podcast, senior contributor at Roto Baller PGA. He's going to give us his U.S. Open thoughts. He is South African. So, again, like with Dan Weston, there will be a language barrier here.
I can't wait for it. Byron's a great golf follow, great golf betting mind, does some great stuff. We haven't had him on the show before. I'm looking forward to it today.
Looking forward to it. And I don't want to do your – I mean, I will do the standard. We'll get all of his picks. But I also want to talk about something that you were impressed by with him some time ago when you listened to a podcast that he was on, which is – he sort of did a autopsy. And by the way, we haven't said this in a long time, but for those who are new to betting or new-ish to betting, you know, you win, you lose, you should always, first of all, you should be recording. If you're doing this seriously, maybe you're doing it for entertainment, you don't care about this. But if you're doing this seriously, you should be logging all of your bets in every sport. You should try to parse them out in as many ways as possible. You know, if you don't want to get too crazy on it, I understand. But you should. The more that you are into it, the more you should. And he did a sort of, you know, retrospective on, or really, really just sort of a analysis of some of his markets that he bet, what he learned from that last year. So I want to get into some of that as well.
Yeah, it was him and Pat Mayo, and I believe it was at the end of last season, I believe is when they did this podcast. But I think it's one for those of us that bet golf regularly, where it's so, you know, how often do we pull up Major League Baseball and you're looking at top ROI teams, bottom ROI teams. Okay, well, how does that kind of translate over to some of these golf betting markets that we talk about a lot, specifically top 10s, top 20s, that type of thing. And, okay, it's great if I can sit here and say I'm betting Xander Schauffele top 10 every week, but those odds are obviously not the same every week. They're moving, right? So at the end of the year, not only how many top 10s did Xander Schauffele hit, but at the end of the year, are you up money and how much and at what odds are those making sense to bet? So there was a very, very good podcast.
I'm feeling geeky today. I'm feeling nerdy.
Let's go.
We're going to go through some baseball stuff as well. This is my favorite new baseball follow. As I fumble the phone here, Brooksgate, you familiar with this guy? I don't know. There used to be back in the day, baseball geeks will remember this. Baseball hardos will remember Brooks by Baseball. I wonder if it's the same person. I don't know if it is or not.
I remember that one. And yes, I did not know of this one when you started sending in.
But whoever is running this site, we got to get him on, or her. Could be her. We got to get this person on because there's a lot of really interesting baseball tweets that we'll get into throughout the show. That I think, you know, one of the things also from just a macro perspective on betting, much of what you are doing in every sport is to try to determine what is sustainable and what is not. So in other words, teams have records, players have records, if it's an individual sport, whatever it is, who has been fortunate, who has been unfortunate, what is actually a proper reflection of skill set. And so baseball is probably the best lab to look at that in and is the most clear. And so we'll get into that throughout the show as well. I want to start with something that we ended up in our text exchange with Wishnev, Fezzik, Will Hill, and Chris Velika yesterday. And I wanted to touch on it because I mentioned it yesterday in passing and didn't really seize on it. And I could, you know, I sensed that I was probably unclear about this kind of thing. So Dan Hurley, we were on the air yesterday, and we didn't know if he was going to take the Lakers job or not 24 hours ago. And I was reading a tweet. I had mentioned it. And someone said, well, you know, follow the money. Before you, they said he was minus 400 in a betting market to become the Lakers' next head coach. And I, in reacting to the tweet, I was just sort of like, oh, okay. And I just kept going. And I didn't mean that to sound flippant about them having said it. What I intended to convey is when it comes to these kinds of markets, and this is just sort of, you know, a betting thing for people, again, who are new to this. When it's a minus 400 in a market, say, at BetOnline or Bovada, right? These are markets that are capped in terms of what people are betting. It could just be $25 for all we know. Maybe it's even less.
Right. Yeah.
And so it doesn't take anything, right? If Woj has a report, three people are going to bet it, and all of a sudden it's minus 400. So I guess what I'm saying is it's just a sort of PSA about these kinds of particular markets, specifically this player to the next team or this coach to the next team. And so as we found out, there was nothing to it, or he turned it down. Whatever story you believe, Dan Hurley says no to the reported 7-year deal for $80 million. Was that the proposed deal that we're getting reported? There are some people who believe that this was
70
all,
million. 6 years, 70.
6 years, 70.
Yeah,
pardon
six
me.
70.
By the way, 6 years, 70 in the scheme of coaching life at the top of your profession, while it sounds like a tremendous, huge amount of money to mere mortals like you and me, I'm not sure that would have been enough to sway Dan Hurley from a two-time college, you know, a repeat college championship coach to coach the Lakers. Like, that should have been way higher than that, shouldn't it?
I think everybody was expecting a higher offer. I mean, it would have put him in line, I think, to be the fifth highest paid NBA coach. I'm trying to look up right now.
What do you believe about this, though? The other opinion on this is this was never anything. That Shams got the scoop on J.J. Redick being a candidate. Woj was upset about it, and then Woj goes and just sort of has connections like, oh, the Lakers, Dan Hurley, this is a thing. Oh, now it's not a thing. Like, I mean, who knows what's real?
I think it was definitely a thing. I think it was definitely a thing. Was it maybe overblown?
That's what I mean.
How much the Lakers wanted him?
That's what I mean.
That's definitely possible.
Yep.
Was it also, I also don't know that I will believe for a second the reporting here has been kind of sketchy timeline throughout.
It was full court press, and then it went away.
Right,
it was quiet.
So the other part that I don't believe, Gil, is okay. This is I've seen specific stuff talking about. Oh no, this was not Dan Hurley treating this as a negotiating tactic. But like, he's instantly going to double his salary from last year to what he's rolling into with next year, likely with UConn. So like, what?
But what I was saying yesterday was also, for 98% of college coaches, this is now a different profession than it was when you took the job. You are now recruiting your own team. You're recruiting other teams' players. That wasn't the job when you took it.
Mm.
But if you're Dan Hurley, you're on the mountaintop, and you have you're already a repeat champion. You're going for the all too rare three-peat. It's a different sort of story. You're the king of stores, Connecticut.
Yeah.
So I don't know, and maybe he's an East Coast guy. And who knows?
And by all accounts, killed it this offseason as far as bringing guys in, keeping guys, and everything like that. So the team's loaded up.
Plus, again, is the Lakers that great of a job? If
Lakers offer, right? And then we heard about this Kentucky offer coming in, and it's like, okay, all it is this guy just. He did a great job negotiating and is going to get more money to maybe stay exactly where he wanted to be at.
Anyway, just that PSA about a betting market like a BetOnline or Bovada. When a number moves like that, it is not always and often not an indicator of actual reality of what's going to happen because it doesn't take much to move that stuff.
Now the Redick side of the stuff's interesting. Like, I don't know where this leaves the Lakers. Like, where are the Lakers at today? I have no idea. No idea.
It's Borrego or it's Reddick. It's probably Borrego in the end.
I'm going to kind of laugh. Sorry, but it's funny if it's Borrego. And that is nothing against Borrego, but that is when Hurley and Reddick have been floated around like this for the past 3 weeks now or whatever, and it's going to end up being him. All right.
It's also why I don't get involved in those markets, even if we could here in Nevada. They're squirrely. You don't know. You don't know what's happening.
Yeah, I think, though, that you're talking about the limits. It's like, I mean...
Not only the limits, but just, I don't know what's happening.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Also, like, biggest piece of advice because of what you're talking about. Yeah. Even if you are limited, I wouldn't be caring too much about it because you shouldn't be betting that much on it.
Hockey last night, the Panthers take a 2-0 lead in the best of seven Stanley Cup final against the Edmonton Oilers, and this just feels like the Panthers are the better hockey team. They're up 2-0 here, the 4-1 win. And the Oilers, it feels like these soccer sides we'll see internationally where one side is clearly better than the other. But if the one side that's worse talent-wise gets a goal first, then they hope to hold on for dear life. Edmonton scored first last night. They got one by Bobrovsky. But then in the scheme of things, the Oilers were just killing off power plays. At one point, it was 34 in a row that they killed off. They only had 7 shots on goal through the first 2 periods. And in the end, Evan Rodriguez with a couple goals to make it 2-1 and then 3-1 in the third period and then an empty netter, 4-1. I was just looking through, because it's 2-0 in both the NBA Finals and the NHL Finals, I was looking at the average number of wins in all of the best of 7 series this year in the NHL and the NBA playoffs. You ready for this? Average number of wins for the losing teams in all the best of 7s. NHL, 1.57 wins per losing team this year.
NHL, wow.
NBA, 1.29. That's how uncompetitive this has been, bottom line. That's not including the current 2-0 series. That's just before this. We're coming back with Drew Dinsick next. Numbers Game, Visa, the Sports Betting Network.
A Numbers Game on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network.
Numbers Game presented by Zyn Nicotine Pouches, America's number one nicotine pouch. Find out more at Zyn.com. Don't forget long shots. Once again, we mentioned this in the first segment. Never too many times to promote it again. Long Shots Podcast, Matt Brown, Wes Reynolds, Kelly Bidlin, U.S. Open betting preview tomorrow, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, right here after A Numbers Game. Everything broken down for the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, North Carolina, where Scottie Scheffler, of course, is the short shot once again. You think you're going to have some top fives on Scheffler?
Yep.
That's the way to go. No.
I already do.
You do already? What number did you get?
I bid at a bit of minus 135 yesterday, but I'm still waiting for shops to open up in town.
All right. We'll get Drew's thoughts on this momentarily. I just want to you're big. Can you share with people? Let me just repeat those stats that I just mentioned, just in terms of this is not a betting thing. It could have been a betting thing, but just in retrospect now, with both the Stanley Cup Final and the NBA Finals at 2-0 in favor of the Florida Panthers and the Boston Celtics, respectively, as the series now head to Edmonton and Dallas, respectively, the average number of wins per these best of sevens before the finals, before the respective finals. Again, in the NHL is 1.57, so 22 total wins by the losers in 14 series up to this point. So 1.57 wins per losing team, and in the NBA this year, and this is the one, this is why I did it, because I was like, how many series did we actually have in these NBA playoffs? 8 playoffs where beforehand, remember, we were like, this is going to be the greatest Western Conference playoffs in the history of Western, right? We were saying that.
Shut up, Gil. I definitely said that like 18 times.
The total number of wins per losing teams in the 14 series that have taken place in the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference prior to the finals, which is 2-0. We're not even talking about that yet. 18 in 14 series, 1.29 wins. There have only been 3 series that have gone to the full 7 games. That was Cleveland-Orlando, which I'm not sure any human being actually saw that series.
Or remembers it.
The one I couldn't remember was Indiana and New York went to 7. I remember when the broadcast crew was eulogizing the Knicks 10 minutes before the end as if they had won 25 championships.
Still one of the best series of the playoffs.
And then Minnesota-Denver, of course, which is the series I would contend ruined the entire playoffs for everybody.
I'm still more surprised by the NHL number, but that's just because I've been watching every single one of these NBA games so intently.
Yeah, it has not been, in terms of just a non-betting perspective, in terms of just a viewer excitement level, that has not been that great of a of a spring with both of those. Drew Dinsick, though, probably feels differently because I think he's got the Boston Celtics, so what does he care? It's Drew now, courtesy of the Progressive Guest Line, the host of not one but two podcasts, The Deep Dive with Andy Molitor, and, of course, NBC Sports Bet the Edge with Jay Croucher, who was throwing out pictures. Jay Croucher, where was he? Was he at the Celtics game?
Yeah, he went on Sunday. He was sitting baseline. Great seats.
Nice.
At the Garden there to see the Celtics home, hopefully. Two more left. Two wins left. It's not over yet.
Well, you got to be feeling good, though, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This was massive, yeah. I mean, if something weird was going to happen in the series, it was going to be Dallas sticking their foot in the door early and getting those two wins, particularly game two, because I thought the Celtics played pretty poorly, all said and all told. They shot really poorly. They were getting incredibly good offensive looks on it, felt like every single possession, but really just kind of struggled until the second half to put the ball through the hoop and getting that one home. Those are the kind of games the Celtics have lost in frustrating fashion throughout this entire run of this core. Seeing that one to the finish line was pretty exciting. Now they go on the road and they basically have, at least by my number, two coin flips. Win one of these coin flips and then take care of business in game five and we can hang banner number 18.
Yeah, I'll repeat what I asked the folks yesterday. The old adage, of course, is a series doesn't start till someone loses on their home court, which you just, again, pointed out. If the Celtics can take one here, maybe the gentleman sweep is coming. But is there anything, I'll ask you to take off your Celtics hat for a second.
Sure.
Is there anything, if you're a Mavericks backer or a Mavericks fan, what do you hang your hat on in those first two games? Like, how do you talk yourself into this?
I mean, I think if you're a Mavericks backer or a fan, you're looking at the shooting statistics and you're saying it can't get worse. It can only improve because they have been obscenely poor shooting the ball.
13 of 53 from yeah. three, by the way. 13 yeah, of 53, yeah. 24.5%.
Yeah, and the higher the stakes in the playoffs, the more of kind of the role player bump it comes at home rather than on the road. If the adjustment of, role players play better, if that comes through in games three and game four, you might get a little bit of a surge. From an X's and O's, from a strategy standpoint, watching the games, it feels like such a clear and obvious mismatch in so many ways. I'm not sure what the Mavericks do. Kind of spitballing, what are some solutions? How do they get the offense going? Well, do they need some PJ Washington at the five? Do we need to get Tim Hardaway out on the floor with these guys to have more shooting? Is Derek Jones Jr., his reluctance to fire, is that a problem? Do you need to get him off the floor? Like, all three of those questions you ask, and like, that unlocks all of the offense for the Celtics. And so then you just have turned it into, a full on shootout, and you're just crossing your fingers that you make the threes and you win the shootout. But, the moments of games one and two where it felt like the Mavericks had a bit of an advantage was when the game really slowed down to a slog. The Celtics weren't really getting into their offensive sets. They weren't getting good looks. They weren't getting into their offensive movements early enough in the shot clock to make them matter. I think the Mavericks could not take advantage of that by turning around those solid defensive possessions and creating offense. I think all of the answers to the tough questions in the series for the Mavericks are bad. The fact that, their most important offensive weapon in Luka is their biggest defensive liability is really kind of fundamentally, the key crux of the problem here. The Mavericks have gotten here in a lot of ways by exploiting the corner three. The Celtics are the best team in the NBA by margin at taking away the corner three. They allow one per game, which is ironically what they have given up to this point in the series. So the Mavericks not getting those free opportunities or those plus EV shots from the corner and forcing most of the open looks for the Mavericks to be above the break has been a huge huge kind of, in my opinion, tactical advantage for the Celtics in this one. And, without the shooters to be able to punish them above the break, I'm not sure what you do if you're the Mavericks. And, there's been a lot of interesting kind of strategy on the Mavericks part, putting two on Tatum for a lot of their defensive sets. And, you know, Tatum has obviously not really shown up on the, in the box score from a shooting or a point standpoint, but he's been absolutely diabolical from a, you know, an assist, a drive and assist, drive and dish role. And if the Mavericks pivot away from having two on Tatum, if that unlocks him a little bit offensively, it wouldn't shock me. So, you're kind of left with nothing but bad options here. If you're if you're the Mavericks coaching staff, and, I think you're just crossing your fingers that the switch to the venue helps with your shooting, and you get some of that role player, home cooking, where those guys just play better, because, you need the Celtics to take a step backwards and your team to take a step forward to close the gap, in my opinion.
5-31. 5-31 is the all-time record for teams trying to overcome a 2-0 deficit in the history of the NBA Finals. 5-31. Again, the last team to do so, the 2021 Bucks with Giannis against Phoenix. The LeBron Cavaliers, who can forget that, against Golden State, where Golden State went scoreless in the last 440 of Game 7. LeBron with the iconic block of Andre Iguodala's shot. The Heat in 2006, Bill Walton's Blazers in 1977, and the Celtics in 1969. In each one of those five cases, the team that was down 2-0 lost the first two on the road. So this is, you know, this would, if the Mavericks are able to do it, this is still the formula, if you will, to do so. Obviously, you don't want to be part of this formula, but it's how the other five got there as well. And let me just ask this in the last minute, and we'll talk other sports here on the other side, but just from a non-betting, from a historical standpoint, the Celtics now, when you put regular season and postseason record together, are 78-20. And I know they had the royal flush of injuries that they played here in the playoffs. but if they end up, let's say it's a gentleman sweep, if they end up 80-21, do you rank this, like, per your numbers, do you rank this as one of the great teams of all time, or is it just a team that was really good that just had a lot of good fortune as well?
I mean, on paper, they are a super team. I think we've even made this commentary on the show. But from the start of the season, you put the pieces together and the ratings together, there's no minuses. Everybody's a plus on both sides of the floor, except for Al Horford is a small minus offensively. Everyone else is a plus on both sides of the floor. Who matters? And that's crazy. And, you know, it's just from a roster building standpoint, it's the perfect roster for this day and age in the NBA. And the fact that they weren't tested, I think, just afforded us opportunities to get prices on the finals that were pretty obscene, I think, in hindsight.
You don't think all those Warriors team crushed them? I'm just curious. I do. Like, in my head, the way I remember it, but, you know, who will never know?
Well, I don't know that they'll be all-time great, but yeah. but they are a super team on paper.
Okay, we'll come back. Drew on tennis and golf and more next.
A Numbers Game on VSiN, the sports betting network.
This segment of A Numbers Game is brought to you by Zyn Nicotine Pouches, America's number one nicotine pouch. Zyn is smoke-free, spit-free, hassle-free, and can be enjoyed anywhere, anytime. Whether you're managing your fantasy lineup on the go, watching the game from the stands, or from your couch, you can get the nicotine satisfaction you want with Zyn. Find your Zyn at your local convenience store or online at Zyn.com. That's Zyn.com. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Thank you, Ryan. Skill Alexander, Kelly Bidlin, live from Bar Canada, the D here in downtown Las Vegas. It is A Numbers Game. Drew Dinsick, kind enough to join us for a second segment at @whale_capper on Twitter, courtesy of the Progressive Guest Line. Again, the podcasts are The Deep Dive and NBC Sports Bet the Edge. Drew, I am curious about your sort of autopsy on your French Open and really clay season. Any lessons learned? How did it go for you?
Well, Eagle won.
That
was a deep exhale.
Yes.
You know, needed it.
Needed it.
That was kind of the key takeaway of the entire, you know, clay cycle. Four French Opens now for Iga, no end in sight. The fact that the most stringent test came from Naomi Osaka mattered a lot, because that kind of helps you understand how to price this fall, which is probably co-favorite Iga Naomi for the US Open, and then second tier Sabalenka Coco.
Yeah.
And then the Rybakina takeaways are all negative out of this until she kind of changes her coaching team strategy. I don't know that I'm really buying into her finding the form that got her to a Wimbledon championship.
What's going on with her? She's like really surly in interviews, and then she looks gaunt.
I don't know. I don't like it, though. Yeah. There are countless examples of women athletes who have questionable relationships with their older male coaches, and she falls into that category for me.
Oh, wow.
And it's probably having some kind of negative effect on her, just, you know, preparation, performance, personal life, who knows. But until she moves on from that guy, I think she's a pass at slam level.
So that's interesting. So I agree with you, Swiatek, Osaka, first tier for US Open. But what about Wimbledon? I brought this up with you a couple weeks ago. If you recall, I said, this is before Novak's injury. I said, you know, the Olympics might mean more to him. The Olympics are right after Wimbledon. This also applies to Iga, by the way, where for her, you know, you go back to Chatrier, you win a gold medal, easy peasy, by comparison. And then you have the other competitors, right, who are like, well, I don't want to really try to mess with Iga and that. Maybe I should really go full bore in Wimbledon. Does that mess up Wimbledon for you to some degree from a handicapping standpoint, all of that?
I mean, it's a little challenging for sure. The weather and the conditions in August in Paris are even more favorable for Iga on that surface. So I don't think that there's realistically anyone who's winning the gold outside of Iga in Paris. Wimbledon is a tougher question because, again, you know, you have this wicked short run up on the grass. You don't really get a ton of data to help you understand who is improving, you know, whose game is, you know, peaking for Wimbledon. There are not as many specialists on grass as there are on clay that you have to worry about. And you look at, you know, just sort of a relatively flat earth on the women's side compared to what was, you know, just a huge, you know, just a monster in Iga versus the field on the clay. So, it's a much tougher pricing. And I think, you know, it's basically wide open. They have obviously slowed down the grass at Wimbledon considerably to where it's not as, you know, not as different as, you know, the faster hard courts that are kind of being played regularly on the women's tour. So I think Iga's probably, you know, should be the favorite there. I don't necessarily agree with the market pricing. And, you know, Sabalenka, I'm perfectly fine giving her more of a pass than Rybakina for the way that she exited French Open. She pretty obviously had some sort of viral ailment.
Yes, she did.
That I think afflicted a lot of players.
Casper Ruud
inclusive.
Yeah.
Yes. So the women's side of the Wimbledon, I would say there are probably six runners who all deserve realistic consideration, and they're, you know, they're the top players on tour, plus John Zdrobor.
Okay, let's get to the US Open at Pinehurst this week. You usually enter Calcutta's. Do you have any other bets currently on this?
No, I'm still licking my wounds from the Masters. I think I'm finally kind of cured from just bleeding money in the golf pools at this point.
Okay.
Especially in the world where Scotty is so dominant.
Yes.
Here. I mean, it's one thing to kind of handicap a field when there is relative small margins at the top of the board, but when you have this type of situation, it just becomes a whole different beast. And I don't really know that. I guess as I look at the odds board right now, I had take no exception at all to Scotty being in the 3-1 range at the top, and the margin between Scotty and tier two with Xander and Rory, I think, is fair. I'm not anywhere as hot on the market as Xander is at all. Similarly, Rory, I don't think either of them really stand out to me as likely winners here. The support for the Live guys is also somewhat stunning. I know Bryson has been good on and, you know, in the Slam, in the majors so far this year, but 20-1 feels like an aggressive price for Bryson. Similarly, Brooks has not shown the same level that we saw from him last year. So those two prices surprise me. Rom 25-1 surprises me. His game is just completely airmailed relative to what you saw from him making the jump to Live. So that whole group of guys is a pass. The only kind of long shot insane play I took was Jordan Spieth in the 66-1 range, just because I just don't, he's got such a he's one of the players that have such a wide delta on performance on a given in a given round in a given tournament that I just don't think you can have him in sort of the 66-1 range. Again, like he could also finish dead last, and I wouldn't be shocked considering the form that he's in right now. So big, taking some swings there. Pinehurst is a tough, Pinehurst is a tough course. I don't think anyone who's cares about golf doesn't already know that. And I think the most interesting thing to sit down and watch this week is going to be, can Scotty finish under par? Because his putter is obviously the one weakness that he's got in his entire arsenal. And this course is going to test that, to the degree that we haven't seen in a while for Scotty. So excited to specifically watch that part of this tournament. And other than that, I'm just going to be a fan.
All right. Every time you come on now, because we're ramping up to the Olympics, Kelly and I get excited when you come on because you're Mr. Olympics. People should know that. And yet, yesterday we were like, we got excited. Then we're like, oh, it's still like 6-7 weeks away. Jeez, we're going to talk to Germany. It was immediately tempered. However, do you have any pearls of wisdom here in any sport this far out?
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm literally, highly ramped up into swimming right now. Swimming, U.S. trials start on Saturday. They will be on Peacock at 8 in the morning qualifying for us on the Pacific Coast. And then finals are going to be at 5 p.m. every day. So you're going to get to watch all the swimming that your heart desires, live from Lucas Oil Stadium, where they put a temporary pool on the Colts field.
Wow.
And they have, and honestly, I was like, well, this is very cool. They usually do it in Omaha. It's usually a very cool setup, but tickets are hard to come by. And now they're putting it in a football stadium. I was like, oh man, the tickets are going to be cheap. There's going to be plenty. Maybe I should go to Indy. No, tickets are expensive and they've sold out. Like, people are very, very fired up for this. And they're all going to be there in India on the in the dome watching the swimming. So that starts on Saturday, goes for a week, and the U.S. trials are going to be pretty telling in terms of just in general what to expect out of the U.S. swimmers. There's been a ton of disruption with kind of coaches moving college programs in the run up here, which is throwing a little bit of a monkey wrench in our program overall. On top of the fact that the world has caught up to us pretty substantially. The U.S. used to dominate swimming. You used to be able to count on about, a medal per event and a gold one out of every three events. And, the Aussies and the women's side caught us and passed us in terms of the quality and depth of their program. And then on the men's side, France has, this wunderkind who, the French Michael Phelps, he's not going to win relays because their team isn't as deep as when Phelps was going for 7 and 8 gold medals. But Marchand is this, French.
Victor Wembanyama, that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah he's the Wembanyama of swimming, and he has a chance to pick up 3 or 4 gold medals in some of the IM butterfly and breaststroke events, which is really kind of an unusual combination. But he is a dynamite swimmer for the French, for the Frogs. I think the Chinese extremely good coming into this cycle. It's going to be a very, very level field and exciting to see if the U.S. Team broadly can step up at the trials next week.
All right, we'll ramp up the Olympics talk next week, but let's file that name away. Léon Marchand, spelled for the American as Leon Marchand. Léon Marchand.
Good job, Gil. Thank you.
Thanks very much. That's what I'm here for.
Leon Marchand.
That's right. Thank you, Drew. Appreciate it, man.
All right, best luck, guys.
Drew, who swam competitively at Duke, by the way. Coming back.
A numbers game on VSiN, the sports betting network.
We are so close to crowning an NBA champ, and with the action heating up on the court, it's even hotter at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now and use code VSIN, that's code VSIN, for new customers to get 150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Only on DraftKings. The crown is yours. It's Gil Alexander. Ladies and gentlemen, I like to call this segment Kelly Bidlin Handicaps the Stanley Cup Final. Kelly? Floor is yours.
You've got it, Gil. You've got it. No problem. I'm just, all I'm going to say is when you're going up with a goaltender situation like this, okay?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You got some great goaltenders in the NHL. Okay, Connor Hellebuck, Sergei Bobrovsky, Igor Shesterkin.
Sure.
Jake Oettinger. Stu Skinner? I can't get there on Stu Skinner. just the name just doesn't fit with the rest of them, Gil. Just doesn't fit.
There it is. Edmonton's got no shot.
Stu
Skinner.
Actually, I've even been calling him the professional Stuart Skinner, but then I heard on the broadcast last night, Stu dropped a couple dimes.
You know,
got to pick it up, Stewie.
Also, right, hockey becomes very, what do we say about the NBA? We just need it. We need access to the three-point scoring stats. In hockey, what do we always say? You know, the old adage of you just need the hot goaltender. If you can't put the puck by the, first of all, you got to take more than seven shots in the first two periods.
Right.
But then if you can't put the biscuit in the basket, period, right, besides the one that slipped by him yesterday, which is sort of a weak goal.
Still trying to figure out how they stand on their heads, so.
That has its origin.
Just don't know how you physically do that.
I once went down that rabbit hole as well.
Want some U.S. Open injury updates.
Please.
Here. So, John Rahm, Drew brought him up last segment. If you've been paying attention to the golf world, he had to withdraw from the LIV event last week. He is dealing what they were calling at the time was an infection in his toe. Forced him to withdraw. There was a video of him in very much pain after a shot that was circulating around social media. He has just arrived to Pinehurst, showed up for his media that was supposed to start at 10:30 Eastern, 7:30 Pacific time. He is talking with the media right now. He has shown up wearing one shoe and one sandal, Gil.
One shoe and one sandal.
Yes, to rest the toe for toe comfort, I guess. He said it is not... I described it as a lesion between his pinky toe and fourth toe that got infected. So this is what John Rahm is dealing with. Quote from John Rahm, it's a concern. It's doing better, but definitely still in pain. So monitor that with John Rahm this week. I really didn't – this was something I was already going to be paying close attention to. I thought better chance than not that he just didn't go. Now that he's at the course, and he has not played a practice round yet, this is his first day here. He was not there at all yesterday. This might have to be a scary load up against John Rahm.
Fade away. Total rookie move on my part. I went ahead and Googled toe lesion or lesion between the toes. I wish I hadn't done that.
So glad you did because I'm not going to now.
Wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah, he was. When he withdrew over the weekend, he was in major pain. So I don't. I mean, it's John Rahm. So, you know, this sounds so bad. Fortunately, as a bettor, you think he's going to try to tough it out as much as he can, probably. Just be careful with your bets. Obviously, they're all going to be voided, canceled if he doesn't tee off. But as soon as he tees off, everything's live.
First segment of the show, I mentioned because we were talking about betting markets and how you shouldn't be swayed by, you know, strange one-off betting markets at, say, a Bet Online or a Bovada Offshore where, you know, Dan Hurley to be the next coach of the Lakers soars to -400. That doesn't mean anything. And I mentioned to Kelly, I don't know if you caught this, in the first segment where I was like, well, you know, on the one hand, was it overblown? On the other hand, some people think, like, it wasn't really a story at all and that Woj has ties, I think similar agents, that kind of thing, and he just sort of manufactured the story being bigger than it ever was. And I guess part and parcel with that, the Lakers' interest wasn't quite as high as it was being drummed up to be. Well, now Shams Charania is killing Woj, killing him. That it was Redick all along. It's always been Redick. It's still Redick. It never wasn't Redick, and it's all
Shams isn't excluding
one big Shams.
Yeah, he's not excluding Borrego either. But yes, he is.
He's saying it's all ready.
The Shams versus Woj stuff has been entertaining, that's for sure.
College World Series, Georgia did not get there. Every time they made a move on NC State yesterday, NC State had the answer. Georgia could not get a big hit. And so four ACC teams and four SEC teams in the College World Series, which begins on Friday.
ACC. ACC. That's how this works, right?
You're not going to stop with that with the SEC chant. So the only one that I have is the first one I made, which is FSU back
Let's
several
go, baby.
Months.
That's the only one I got live, too.
Let's go. We'll get some College World Series guys on this week.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have the updated odds.
Yes.
If we want to take a look at those quick, as I'm struggling to pull up. Updated odds right now for the College World Series. Tennessee +290, Texas A&M +330, Kentucky plus 500, North Carolina plus 600, Florida State plus 750, Virginia 9-1, NC State 11-1, Florida then 12-1.
Florida was the only one of those eight that was not one of the top 16 seeds. So they are the long shot there at 12-1. And Tennessee was always the number one seed, so they're plus 2-9.
I feel like they're dogging our Florida State squad a little bit in these odds, man. Like, I mean, Virginia, NC State, Florida kind of weren't supposed to be here, right? But wasn't Florida State was. Maybe a little bit on the edge. Yeah, but
on the edge, right. On the edge. Still can get plus 750 on them. Okay. And then, by the way, the other thing that happened last night, the Astros, my Astros most wins in June thing, Giants magic got them last night. The Astros on the heels of a game where they were leading by two in the eighth, and they gacked it. They gacked a two-run lead in the 10th yesterday to Giants magic. So that wasn't good. But, you know, ironic. Giants magic got me. Mm. Want to do, speaking of baseball, I want to shout out this guy, Wishnev. Todd Wishnev was the guy who made me aware of this. This is the name of the account. Again, I don't know if this is like Brooks, was it Brooks Baseball, Baseball by Brooks back in the day. But this is Brooks Gate, and they've got some great stuff. And it's just, again, a way of saying that in handicapping, what you're trying to do is look at sports in a way that what's sustainable, what's not, what is real, what's not. That's why Mark Borchardt and I do the Q1 and the Q2 and the Q3 derivative. What is narrative? What is predictive? So here's just a handful of tweets from Brooks Gate that put baseball in perspective. This one, how many times your starting pitcher has pitched 7-plus innings in a game? For those who can't see this graphic, let's just point out that a bunch of these are sort of, I'd say 26 of baseball's 30 teams are between the numbers 4 and 12. Mm-hmm. 4 to 12 times that starting pitchers have pitched 7-plus innings in a game. There are only two teams that soar above 12. That is the Atlanta Braves, is that right there?
Let me Braves tell you.
The
Atlanta
Braves with 16.
16.
16. Sorry, Kelly. 16 times. And at 20 times, the Philadelphia Phillies, 20 times as their starting pitchers gone 7-plus innings in a game. And that makes sense, right? That one makes sense because it's the Phillies, and there's Nola, and there's Wheeler, and there's Suarez. And so they've got great starting pitching, and yeah, that makes sense. The one that doesn't make sense, and I'll ask Spore about this, the very bottom, the Milwaukee Brewers, only two. I would never have expected that from the Brewers. That's probably the most fascinating part about that.
I mean, the Phillies, it's been everybody on the staff except for Taiwan Walker, right?
Yeah, it's been the best starting rotation in baseball for sure. Here's another one. This is all for the Yankees lovers out here. This is a very straightforward one. It doesn't even have a graphic. The Yankees pitching staff has their lowest Ks per nine since 2015. So their lowest strikeout rate since 2015 and their highest walk rate since 2010. Those are both bad things, right?
Correct.
Lowest K rate since 2015. This is the Yankees pitching staff as a whole since 2015 and the highest walk rate since 2010. And yet, they also lead Major League Baseball in ERA. So this is fascinating because for all the Yankees love that's out there, what this portends, and I get it, Garrett Cole's coming around the mountain, so I get it. There's reinforcements coming. But to this point, as a collective, that stuff doesn't jibe. And the Yankees pitching staff has been on the right side of good fortune. Let's put it that way. They've been on the good fortune side. Because you can't have – that's not sustainable over the long haul. But, again, what's the caveat? Here comes Garrett Cole.
This makes my brain hurt. I didn't read this close enough earlier this morning when you sent this to me. That is shocking.
It's wild.
Well, it's defense and luck?
It's all of the above, yeah.
Right? Like, that's it, right? Yeah.
Well, wow. And this gets back to, again, our point last year about, and again, we didn't win it in the end, but I hope people understand the point of it, which is why the Blake Snell thing winning the Cy Young, by the way, Blake Snell's performance this year is sort of corroboration of this. Blake Snell's Houdini act last year was historic. It was epic. You cannot continue to have a soaring bases on balls rate. You can't issue walks at such a high rate and then keep having a Houdini act and having a historic strand rate, which, remember, we invoked the name of John Candelaria of the Pirates in the 70s as the only strand rate that was higher than Snell's last year in modern baseball history. But these are the interesting things about baseball. Is the performance real to date? Is it sustainable? That would indicate that Yankee stat that it is not. But Cole is coming. Golf next.